In 2004, director Steven Spielberg and star Tom Hanks partnered up to give the world a quirky dramedy that warms the heart.
In 2021, we return to Scotland to try the favorite brand of our two hosts.
The film is The Terminal.
The whiskey is Glenmorangie 13 Cognac Cask.
And we'll review them both. This is
The Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
Bob, I am so pumped. Do you want to know why I'm so pumped?
Wait, who are you?
Oh, I'm Brad G.
Hi, Brad G.
But you want to know what I'm pumped about, Bob Book?
What are you pumped about, man?
It's Thanksgiving! I'm so freaking jazzed, dude.
Dude, I got to tell you, I'm really shocked that there's not more Thanksgiving themed things out there in the world. This seemed like the biggest no-brainer ever for our podcast.
Yeah, we need to trademark it, man. This is like a gold mine.
We're going to trademark Tom Hanks.
Yes, I would like to do that, please. Can I have a patent on Tom Hanks?
We are in year two of Thanksgiving. Last year, we did our very first one, which was the Penny Marshall classic Big. This year, I don't know how it lined up so perfectly. We were actually planning to do another separate episode of Tom Hanks' movie for Thanksgiving and release it as a bonus episode. But because we landed on The Terminal for this week, all we're basically doing is instead of releasing it the following Monday, we're pushing the release up a little bit. And this is coming out on Thanksgiving on Thursday. So Film and Whiskey Nation, you get two episodes this week. You're welcome.
Yeah. And I've heard that the best way to garner listens for your podcast is to release them on a major holiday.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is like a win-win for everybody.
Listen, Brad, I know someone is out there stuffing a turkey right now and they're like, you know what? Screw it. Let's listen to Bob and Brad while I do this. So to those people, I say welcome aboard.
I would say Austin's family, we apologize.
I was going to say Aperture Flash, our Canadian truck driver. It's not Thanksgiving for him. It's just Thursday.
That is true. You're welcome.
Well, today, as we said, we are looking at the 2004 film The Terminal. Brad, for anybody who is new to the podcast or just isn't familiar with what we're doing this season, we've kind of taken a little bit of a break from watching films that I think, you know, most people would regard as classics or as highly thought of or historic game-changing movies. And we just wanted to put together a list of movies that you and I really like for one reason or another, or movies we haven't been able to revisit in a while that we just want to talk about. And this week, The Terminal is a movie from my list. It's a movie that I first saw when I was either just starting high school or, just getting ready to go into high school in 2004. I really love this movie. It is, admittedly, I'll say it up front here. It's not a perfect movie. I wouldn't even go so far as to call it a great movie. I think that watching it back this time, I am very content with knowing that sometimes you just like a movie and it works for you and it works on you and like it might not work on anybody else, but I am totally open to interpretations of this movie that range from like, yeah, it's mediocre, I'd give it like a 6, to yeah, I think it's really, really charming and it's not perfect, but I just fell in love and I'm going to give it like a 9. Do you know what I mean? Like I'm open to a pretty wide range of reactions here.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to like give this a two-word summary, I would say it's pleasantly charming.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think like part of it too is I saw it at the right age where, you know, the way that they film New York City and the whole kind of jazz-inflected score from John Williams, I just found everything.
I don't know if you understand, they actually don't film New York City in this movie. They film a airport terminal.
Well, the last shot of the movie is Times Square, so they definitely do film a little bit of New York City, but let me finish my GD point here.
Know.
So I just found it to be like a very, I wouldn't call the movie itself like an overly romantic movie, but it's a romanticized version of life. And, you know, going into high school, like I was just really starting to ask girls out on dates for the first time, and this movie just kind of seemed like a perfect, like, oh, we're going to go on a first date kind of movie. Do you know what I mean? And it just really stuck with me for a long time afterwards. And I think it's because even though it is a fairly standard script, it just happens to have like some of the best in the business working on it. It's got Tom Hanks. It's got Catherine Zeta-Jones basically coming off of an Oscar win. It's got Steven freaking Spielberg behind the camera. Like, this material has no right to have such a murderer's row lined up to execute it. And yet it does. And it's really cool.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really it's at kind of the core of this movie is that this movie just has this plucky heart and spirit behind it that I think desperately needed Tom Hanks to be at its core. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. he just has this ability as an actor to just make you fall in love with him and like want to root for him yeah. in almost any movie that he's ever in. Like, yeah. I don't know if I've ever really seen him as a villain. And there's a reason for that. You just want to believe in something good in this world. And that good in this world is represented by Victor Navorsky in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, this movie is relentlessly optimistic and hopeful. And I think that, you know, we'll probably get into talking a little bit about the historical context here of like what America was going through at this time, what Spielberg really wanted to put on screen at this time historically. And I do think it really falls into, or I do think it really makes a lot more sense when you think about it from that lens. But just on its own merits, watching this movie, even 17 years later, I think you're right. It's got that sort of Spielberg optimism, and it's got that, you know, the almost aw shucks nature that Tom Hanks does just so effortlessly.
And it also kind of has this almost like Ferris Bueller's Day Off quality about it, where like everything kind of could work in real life, but there's like just a little bit of fantasy put in yeah. there to make it seem like Tom Hanks could do all the things that he does.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like this perfect little formula for a really cute and funny, charming type movie.
Yeah. And I feel like it always just falls short of becoming a great movie. Like, there are little gags here and there that end scenes, like, you know, Tom Hanks tripping on a wet floor, and that's the punchline, that are kind of like, all right, that seems like a very cheap way to get a laugh. But, you know, in the midst of all that, I do feel like Spielberg is really able to tap into a very human core in this movie. And that's kind of what elevates this above just being like a 6 out of 10 for me. But I do want to talk to you, Brad, about this, because this was your first time seeing The Terminal. Is that correct?
Yeah. And honestly, so I'm going to throw back to maybe season 1, probably season 2. Do you remember watching a movie called Lost in Translation?
I sure do.
I 100% somehow got these two movies mixed up in my brain.
Oh, interesting.
And I thought that Lost in Translation was about a guy who gets stuck in a Japanese airport for like a month or two. And like that is what I thought Lost in Translation was about. And I don't remember if I said that on the episode or not, but I think they both came out in a similar time period, 2003, 2004 area. Mm-hmm. And there is just something about the two movies, like they're about traveling and stuff, that I completely just mashed the two together.
That's hilarious.
So that's my understanding of The Terminal.
I took a lot of notes in this movie on movies this kind of rips off or movies it reminds me of. I do think there's a lot of cinematic influences at work here. Lost in Translation was not one I would have thought of, but I think it's really funny the way that, you know, sometimes your brain just kind of conflates two completely different things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guarantee you what happened was I saw a preview for both of these movies while I was going to see, like, I don't know, Lord of the Rings or a Harry Potter movie or something. And my brain just put them together. So.
Well, Brad, before we go any further, I think it's time for Brad Explains, the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the plot of the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. That is the case today. So, Brad, as you know, you get 60 seconds on the clock to share with us the plot of The Terminal. Do you think you can do it?
I think I might have a chance. The Terminal is about a Eastern European man from a fictional country called Cracovia. He travels to the U.S. to find a legendary jazz player and get his signature on a card for his father, who has passed away. You don't really find that out to the end, but in Brad Explains, you find it out right now. So he travels to the U.S., and in the middle of his flight from Europe to the U.S., his country has a military coup. It is no longer recognized by the U.N. or by America, and so he's now a man without a country. He is not allowed to leave the terminal, but he's also not allowed to fly back. He's kind of a no man, and so they set him adrift in the international hub of JFK, and the rest of the movie is Mr. Navorsky battling his wits against the evil director, falling in love with Catherine Zeta-Jones, and making a great group of friends.
Time.
Boom.
Nicely done, sir.
Yeah, dude.
I feel like this movie, it's not plot heavy, but you really got to buy into the setup. And, you know, doing a little bit of background on this movie, Brad, I found out that this actually was based on something that really happened. Now, it obviously didn't happen to the extent of this movie where, you know, somebody was living in the airport for months and months and months, but it really prompted the screenwriters to think like, okay, what would happen if this kind of thing went down? Whose jurisdiction does this person fall under? And I really liked, you know, in the first part of the movie, when the inciting incident happens, when, you know, Victor lands, he speaks no English. And I think they do a really great job kind of milking the audience's emotions there with Tom Hanks just like breaking down, crying, looking at what's happening to his country on TV, and no one understands what he's trying to say. But they do a really good job of making the sort of like the bureaucratic red tape stuff not be boring. They really distill it down to like what you need to know for this plot to work. And I love that they do it really quickly and the plot's in motion and you understand no one's going to claim this guy. He's just set adrift here in the airport and we have to watch what happens next.
And Bob, I think what really sells the red tape scenes is Stanley Tucci, right? Like
the Tucci.
Bro, the way he is so precise about the about how he opens up his lunchbox and pulls his food out, and like the joy that he takes in the red tape makes it bearable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you can tell the way he's explaining it, like he wants to milk every ounce of joy he can get out of explaining these rules to someone that like he is so oblivious. He loves the rules so much that he's oblivious to the fact that Mr. Navorsky is understanding none of it.
Yeah.
And that like that's the comedy that takes place there. And I don't think it takes place if you don't have somebody like Stanley Tucci playing those moments so daggone perfectly.
Well, then let's just do this, Brad, because I could go in a lot of different directions. There's a lot of things I do want to talk about with this movie that have to do with what works and what doesn't work. But while we're on the Stanley Tucci thing, I think I would have brought this up later in the show, but let's talk about his character a little bit, because I think there are times when they give his character really interesting kind of idiosyncrasies. Like even when his like second in command is saying like, hey, why don't you just kind of set him up and have someone come get him? And he's like, no, I'm not going to lie to take care of somebody like Victor Navorsky. Like it provides a really interesting wrinkle in that he wants to beat him on his own terms. Like he wants to get Victor out of his airport, but he's not going to lie to do it. But at the same time, a lot of the things that they have his character do really just seem to be for the convenience of the plot, because otherwise this would be like a 25-minute long movie. And
yeah,
I really started to question what they were doing with his character towards the end of the film. Like, so Tucci's character is acting field commissioner. He's kind of in charge of what's going on security wise at the airport. And he's interviewing for, you know, the big boss, basically, because his boss is retiring. He wants Tucci to replace him. And basically during his interview process, you know, this kind of whole calamitous thing goes down with somebody that's trying to smuggle prescription drugs out of the country.
Why are you doing this, Victor?
Medicine is for good.
No, it's not.
Yes.
No, it's not.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No. You've been reading the immigration forms, the blue one.
Blue?
Yep, blue.
Blue?
Blue, the blue form. The one that says if it's an animal, he doesn't need the medicinal purchase license. Mm-hmm. You know it. No, then he can just bring the drugs in. It's very good, Victor. That's very good. Why are you doing this? Huh?
You don't know him. You don't know the rules. Look at me. I was going to help you.
From that moment on, Tucci, like, has a vendetta against Tom Hanks's character, Victor, and vows, like, I'm never going to let you out of this airport. And it's just like, why would that be your response? And for the rest of the movie, he just kind of really tips into, like, mustache twirling villain role. And I don't understand it. And I do think it's just at the end of the day, I think it's just a weakness in the script that they made him go to that place.
I don't know. I think that for me, that portion of the script actually made a ton of sense to me, that for somebody who's lives so desperately by the rules, but he is using the rules for his own enjoyment and pleasure and power. I think that when you have such a pure-hearted rule follower like Navorsky, it gets under his skin, right? Because you can tell that Navorsky doesn't do anything he does for his own power, his own gain. And yet, by the end of the film, Victor Navorsky has more power than he does. Mm-hmm. And both of them did it by following the rules. Yeah. Both of it did it by not, you know, bowing under pressure. Both of them are strong-willed. And yet, at the end of the day, Tom Hanks's character is greater than that of Tucci's.
Right. And I mean, it really gets back to this whole, like, Jean Valjean and Javert thing. You know what I mean? This is a much more kind of lighthearted version of that. But Tom Hanks wins because he makes relationships with people and the people love him. And, you know, even the people working for Tucci are kind of like, man, why are you being such a stickler for some of this stuff? And it gets back to that sort of like law and grace argument we had, you know, with the Tree of Life, with Les Mis. It's kind of crazy to think that The Terminal is like in that group of movies too, but it really is. That's the dichotomy they're setting up here.
Yeah, it's its own cinematic universe, the law versus grace. No, I also think that having Hugh Jackman as Victor Navorsky and Russell Crowe, but they're wearing their costumes from Les Mis,
right,
all throughout The Terminal.
I will say
they gave, be brilliant.
I will say they gave Tucci some of the funniest moments in the movie. And I don't know how many of them were improvised. It seems like some of them were kind of improvised and Spielberg kept them in. But especially like the first time they try to convince Victor to walk out the doors, and Victor, he doesn't understand much English, but he understands, like, I'm being set up here. And it's because they have this little security camera following him around as he walks towards the door, and he can hear the, like, the whirring of the machine. And he kind of bends over to see if the camera is going to follow him. You know, he kneels down and is tying his shoe, and Stanley Tucci is up in like the control center watching him. And he's just saying out loud, like, what is he praying? Do they pray at noon? What are they doing? He just has so many little throwaway lines like that, that I thought in a lot of cases, he was probably the funniest person in the movie.
Oh, 100%. Like I said, it's the fact that his character is so desperate to follow the rules, and yet he also has this like fanaticism about keeping his terminal orderly and clean and free of undesirable elements. And you can understand why somebody living in your terminal, taking showers in the bathrooms and, you know, eating crackers with mustard and ketchup on them, like, you can understand how that would get under his skin. Mm-hmm. And it just, like you said, it leads to just so many brilliant moments where he just can't comprehend why Victor is doing the things that he is doing.
Well, before we get into a couple more of the cast here, because there's a number of people I think we need to talk about, I do want to make one more comparison to another movie this reminded me of that we've done pretty recently, and that was WALL-E. And Brad, I don't think this movie is like going overboard as an indictment of like American culture. I mean, it's definitely there, you know, like Stanley Tucci representing the bureaucracy of America versus all these other
people. The Patriot Act.
Right. Versus all these other people representing like what America really means. You know, they're all immigrants. Like, it's a very obvious parallel they're trying to draw there. But Spielberg just kind of barely touches on it. But the whole idea that Victor is stranded in this terminal, where somebody even says to him, like, there's only one thing you can do here, shop. Like, there's just nothing but consumerism going on all around him. And you learn pretty quickly that the only people who really know what's up, or the only people that are capable of having like real human relationships, are the people who like aren't participating in that system at all. Do you know what I mean? It's like the guy who mops the floor and the guy who delivers food. Like, they're the ones who notice Victor. They're the ones who reach out to Victor and really form relationships with him. And it really reminded me of that scene in WALL-E where, you know, they kind of accidentally bump the person and their little screen in front of their face shuts off. And they look out and realize, like, oh, there's this great big quote unquote world out there that I've never seen because I've been looking at a screen this whole time. And it really reminded me of that. Like, there was that element of looking beyond what's immediately in front of your face.
Well, and I think it really sets up American life so well, and especially in representing New York. That, you know, like you said, the movie is set kind of in New York. It's set in the major airport. And you get this sense, this understanding that life is transient, that life is about buying things. Life is about moving from one place to another. And when you actually sit and stay in a place, when you spend time there, when you get to know the people who inhabit those spaces, there's value to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that this movie really hits the nail on the head on.
Yeah, I mean, it's right there staring you in the face from the beginning. Like, the setting of this movie is a place that no one wants to be any longer than they have to. And transient is the perfect word for it, Brad. It's a transitory place. Like, you go through it and you don't spend any time there. And it's about how do you find home in a place that is designed for you to not spend more than 1 minute here. And I really just love that as kind of like the selling point of a movie. It's a guy that has no home who makes a home in, you know, the least conducive place for it.
Well, and in the middle of this, you know, place where he's trying to find a home, I love how he kind of carves out a little niche of his own. It's this little spot. He makes a bed. I love how resourceful they make him, that he has like practical craftsman-like abilities. There's just so many things to love about this script that I'm just going to come back to it. It's just a daggone charming movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's no other way of saying it. Almost everything about this movie is just slightly magical.
So she had a boyfriend. For how long?
2 years. And what happened?
Eat shit.
What?
Eat shit.
Eat shit?
Eat shit. Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit.
Well, okay, try to repeat exactly what she said.
Eat shit. She catch him.
So. Oh, he cheats.
Yes, 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 yes. What we call cross catch. We say cross catch. Uh-huh. Yes. One man, uh-huh. Two women. Uh-huh. So, crowded, you know.
Okay, he cheats.
Mm-hmm.
You say cheats, not
cheat.
Shit. No, cheat.
Enrique, you? No shit.
No cheat.
No shit.
Yeah, yeah, no. I want cheat, not shit.
She's a nice girl. She won't take your shit.
Oh, I totally agree. And I guess before it sounds like we're both going to give it 10s out of 10, because I'm not, and I love this movie. I think the problems with this movie kind of start and end with Catherine Zeta-Jones' character.
Yeah.
And I think partially it's because she's underwritten. They make her show up for the convenience of the plot, and she really never is fleshed out any farther than that. Also, I think it's pretty obvious that Catherine Zeta-Jones and Tom Hanks don't really have any chemistry. You know, if this was like a Meg Ryan role, I think we'd be in a completely different spot. And that's not to say that I think Catherine Zeta-Jones does a bad job in the movie. Like, I don't think that at all. I just don't think they really give her character much to do. And at the end of the day, I don't know that this movie needed a romance subplot.
Yeah, I mean, it takes up a decent amount of screen time as well. And I remember hitting the end of this movie and thinking to myself, you know, this probably could have been like an hour and 40 minutes, and it would have been a phenomenal movie. But there's just enough of shag on this, and a lot of it is related to Catherine Zeta-Jones. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about her. So she's coming off of an Oscar win for Chicago. She's won Best Supporting Actress. I think she's another one of these actresses that I just haven't heard much from her in the last 10 years. She's done a lot of TV. I think she's a very good actress, and I really love what she's trying to do with this character. And this is one of those movies, Brad, that it always reminds me of another movie, and more than any other movie that I've mentioned so far, her character in this movie reminds me so much of Shirley MacLaine's character from The Apartment. Like, they're the exact same character. They are like, you know, they work in very high stress environments with kind of somewhat predatory males working around them. They're both philandering with these men who are cheating on their wives, and they're both very emotionally hurt. And it just seems like they really used that Shirley MacLaine, Miss Kubelik character as the template for the flight attendant here in the terminal.
Yeah, and there's just not a lot of substance there, right? Mm. Like her most courageous thing that she does is come back and tell, you know, Tom Hanks that she broke up with her boyfriend. But then the minute she has an opportunity to go back to him, she does.
Well, and again, like, it's I didn't know how to interpret that, because she does it so that she can get him his visa, right? His one-day visa. And so it's like, are we supposed to view that as self-sacrifice? Like, she knew what was going to happen if she went back to him, and she did it for Victor? Or is it, we're supposed to see her as, like, ultimately unredeemable, like, in terms of she'll never be able to get over this thing? And so she's in a contrast with Victor, who knows what he wants and goes home at the end of the movie. She will never have a home. And it's like, I can't tell which way they want me to think about this. And I think ultimately that's like a really huge flaw with the way that relationship wraps up in this movie.
Well, and I think the other problem with the romantic relationship being written at all is that I feel like this movie, one of the opportunities it had to shine was in being just vastly different than most other dramedies out there. And by adding in this, what felt like a cut and paste type of relationship, it just kind of took away from the uniqueness of this movie. Hmm. You know, like if you get rid of the romantic relationship, then you really keep the focus on this is a man who's desperately trying to honor the memory of his father. And he doesn't need a romantic interest to advance his character at all. He doesn't need a romantic interest to get him what he needs. He's able to get it based on his own actions and activities and good-hearted nature. Mm. Like, I would have loved if they had, instead of using, you know, Catherine Zeta-Jones, if they had just stuck with the friend group that he had made and they found a way to smuggle him out for an evening and then bring him back without Tucci ever finding out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, honestly, like a Ferris Bueller's Day Off type of situation. Yeah. Like, seeing Tucci run around the terminal looking for Navorsky and being, like, shunted around by his, you know, by Navorsky's friends, I think that could have been a phenomenal type of sequence. Well, I'm with you, man. I think that Catherine Zeta-Jones, it's not her fault. I think she's pleasant and charming and nice in this movie, but she doesn't have chemistry with Tom, and it just feels too much like a stock movie.
Yeah.
And I'm just not a big fan of it.
So one thing that critics have always kind of criticized Spielberg for is not just that he doesn't really portray romantic relationships, you know, or that his movies are so kind of chaste, but that he seems very awkward even kind of dealing with those issues in the movie. And I think that actually kind of plays out a little bit here. So they have this scene that becomes kind of like the, in some ways, like the emotional turning point of the movie, where Victor finally explains to her character, Amelia, why he's in New York. And it's to get this signature for his dad that died. He made a promise to go get this signature of this famous jazz musician. And then it turns out that he has built her like this incredible, what's that called? Like a mosaic? Not a mosaic.
Yeah. It's like a mosaic fountain.
Yeah. This fountain that's supposed to shoot water. And they had this very romantic, supposedly, kiss in front of the fountain. And I have just always found that that is like one of the most awkward on-screen kisses I've ever seen. And it's supposed to be like this big moment. And it has this incredible John Williams score underneath it, and the way that the light is sparkling off of this fountain, it's so beautifully filmed. And you see them kiss, and then Spielberg cuts to a shot where, like, they're still kissing, and he pulls all the way back across the room. And what you see is, like, Catherine Zeta-Jones and Tom Hanks are standing like two kids at like a fifth grade dance that they've said, like, you have to stay 3 feet apart, and they've leaned their upper bodies into each other, but their lower bodies are still 3 feet apart. And it is like, it's painful to see how they, you know, blocked that scene, because I think it really does further hurt like any romantic chemistry that could have been happening in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it really felt like a drunk Elliot trying to kiss this girl in the middle of the classroom.
That may have been more romantic than what we actually got here.
It might have been. it would have only been better if Tom Hanks had, like, kicked one of his friends down onto the ground and was, like, standing on them to be able to kiss her.
Oh, man. All right, Brad, I think we should hit pause here. We're on a pretty good roll with this movie. I do want to get into a little bit more nitpicks and kind of analysis in the second half, but we should hit pause and try the first of our 5 Glenmorangies. What do you say?
Let's get to it.
All right, so today we are checking out Glenmorangie 13-year finished in cognac casks. Brad, I am very excited for this. We are entering into a 5-week partnership here with the Glenmorangie Company. We're actually going to be featuring their national brand ambassador for an interview on an upcoming bonus episode. But for each of the next 5 regular episodes, you're going to hear us review a Glenmorangie expression.
And which I am wildly excited because Glenmorangie is banging.
I feel like I have been trying for years to figure out the best way to finally get them featured as a brand on here, because way back in season 1, we got that Glenmorangie sampler of 4 scotches. And I think that's what, for me at least, that's what made me fall in love with scotch. Like, I was pretty much strictly a bourbon person. And then we had that Quinta Rubin, and it was like, okay, all bets are off at this point. To this day, Quinta Rubin is still one of the 1 or 2 highest rated whiskeys we've ever had on this podcast. I love it so much. It is like my go-to buying somebody a gift whiskey.
Yep.
And it just delivers such an incredible value. I can't wait to try what's in our glass here today.
Yeah, this is our Glenmorangie. It's a 13-year scotch, and they do it for about 8 years in a ex-bourbon barrel, and then they finish it for the last 4 to 5 years in a ex-cognac cask. So Bob, you're getting a decent amount of time in this cognac cask, mm-hmm. and I'm really curious to see what kind of flavor that imparts.
Brad, are you a cognac drinker by any chance?
I'm not, Bob. I knew that cognac was like in the brandy line of yes. liquors.
Yep.
But even then, I had to figure it out. Brandy is distilled wine.
Correct.
So cognac is a type of distilled wine, and it is very dark and fruity from what I have heard.
Yeah, it's aged in the same general way that whiskey is aged. So it's like you take brandy and you age it like whiskey. So instead of being, you know, fermented grains, it's fermented grapes that are then distilled and aged in barrels. You know, Hennessy is probably the most famous worldwide brand of cognac. So I'm really excited to try this, Brad. I'm hoping that it has that sort of really nice sweetness that we get with some of these Glenmorangie finishes. Let's stop talking about it, though. Let's get into it. What are you picking up on the nose here?
As I get into nosing this, it's got this really nice creamy plum and orange mixture that has little bits of brown sugar and cherry thrown in there. I honestly really like this nose a lot. It's probably an 8.5 for me, Bob.
See, Brad, I'm actually going to disagree with you right off the bat here. And this is coming from a guy who loves Glenmorangie. This just kind of smells like a fairly standard Glenmorangie nose. Like, I don't know that I would immediately pick up on, you know, this has been finished in something for 5 years. And what's here from the cognac casks, as far as I could tell, seems to be pretty mild. I get a lot of, like, saline on the nose of this, and it just kind of smells like your standard sherried scotch, which is not to say it's a bad thing, but I was really hoping for a little bit more depth. Especially like some fruitiness here on the nose. I'm only going to give this a 7 out of 10 on the nose.
Well, when I get into the taste, for me, it stays at a similar level of quality, but there's like an explosion of almost like a cream cheese frosting up front with bits of oatmeal and brown sugar kind of following in the middle of the palate. I really like this taste a lot. I'm going to give it an 8.5 again.
Do you pick up some peat on this?
Just like a wisp. Hint.
Like it's I wanted to just call it smoky on the back end of the palate, but I think it goes beyond smoke to like there might be a little bit of peat going on here, which is not something that Glenmorangie is necessarily known for. So that was really surprising to me. I'm with you. I think that this definitely tips a little sweeter on the flavor than it did on the nose. But for me, the smokiness of this really took over, especially towards the back of the palate and then into the finish as well. Brad, I gotta say, like, I know that I came in here wanting this to like raise the bar even higher than Quinta Rubin did for us. And it's letting me down a little bit so far based on that. It's not fair to hold it to that standard. This is still really good. But I think even so far, I would say that my preferred wheelhouse would be the Quinta Rubin on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally fair. For me, this is just a very different experience. Mm-hmm. And I can understand how that's not as good as the Quinta Rubin. I don't think this is as good as the Quinta Rubin. But as I get into the finish, for me, I don't think it's smoky as much as I think it's oaky.
Okay.
Like, I really feel like I'm getting a really heavy and dark finish. There's a lot of plum going on, a lot of oak. Not what I was expecting out of this whiskey, but honestly, still impressive. I think I'll give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm just going to give it a 7 out of 10 again on the finish. This one, you're right, the oak was there, but for me, it was still smoky. Like, as I breathed out, I was like, oh, there's some campfire going on in my mouth here a little bit. So I'm sticking at a 7 out of 10 on the finish. When it comes to balance, I do think this is a well-balanced whiskey. Just because it's not what I was expecting doesn't mean that it's not delivering what it promised to me. So from the nose to the taste to the finish, this is a pretty well-balanced whiskey. I'm going to give it a 7.5 out of 10.
I think I'll give it a 7 out of 10. For me, nothing really like stood out in a super strong way. And the nose and the palate and the finish, they all have kind of a bit of a variable to them. You really move unexpectedly from piece to piece. So I'll give it a 7 out of 10 on balance. And as we look at the value, the best we can figure out is that this costs around $85. It's not sold in the state of Ohio, so we can't necessarily get the OHLQ price, which is always helpful. But at $85, Bob, I think I'm going to give this a 6 out of 10. I think it's a solid expression of Glenmorangie. I really like what they're doing here, but it's just hard to beat that Quinta Rubin value.
Yeah.
And so for me, this is above average. It's not the worst value in the world, especially in the world of scotch. So $80 to $90, I'll give it a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10. I think you're right, man. You get Quinta Rubin for like $58, $59. This one's $85. If I'm paying that much more, I want to know that what's in the bottle is better or that I'm just getting more of it. And that's, you know, neither one is the case here. I will say at 92 proof, this drank much spicier than I was expecting it to drink. Like it definitely packed a punch. And so I did something that I don't always do with my whiskey. I added a few drops of water to see what that would do to the flavor profile. And I actually thought that this whiskey benefited a lot from having just 3 or 4 drops of water added to it. It really brought out kind of like a waxy white chocolate note to me, which was really, really nice. And there was a level of sweetness and butteriness there that wasn't there before. So my recommendation, if you do try this one, consider adding a couple drops of water to dilute it down a bit. But I'm coming out, Brad, to a 33.5 out of 50. What are you coming out to?
I'm at a 38 out of 50, Bob.
Oh, wow. Wow. I didn't think you'd be that high. All right. So that is bringing us out to a 71.5 out of 100 or a 35.75 out of 50. Brad, as you know, 35 is where we generally start to recommend trying a whiskey. I would recommend trying this. I don't think I would recommend buying a bottle, though.
I think I'm in a similar spot as you. If you're really big into scotch, then go for it. It's a really, really good expression of a non-peated, just really beautifully smooth whiskey. But I think I'd lean towards where you're at. Get a dram of it at your local bar before you buy a whole bottle.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we want to say thank you again to Glenmorangie for sending us this bottle. We've got 4 more lined up, Brad. I absolutely cannot wait to get into those. But for now, we need to get back into talking about the Terminal. What do you say?
Let's get to it.
All right, that was Glenmorangie 13-year finished in cognac casks. We are getting back into talking about The Terminal. Brad, I figured that if nothing else, even if you came into this episode really not liking this movie, that you would be pleasantly surprised by the John Williams score. I know you're a huge John Williams fan. This is low-key one of my favorite John Williams scores. He doesn't do jazz stuff very much. And of course, like, I think the famous kind of theme from this movie is that Eastern European sounding kind of bouncy theme. I think it's called Victor's theme. But my favorite motif or theme in this movie is that sort of romance jazzy theme that comes about, you know, during the kiss. It comes about at the end of the movie when he says, I'm going home. And it's the, you know, dun, 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 dun. It's so freaking good. It gets stuck in my head all the time. And like, truly, among all of John Williams' super famous scores and themes that he's developed over the years, it's one of my probably top five, top 10 favorites.
Yeah, it really feels like Williams had a chance to kind of stretch his legs a little bit here, get out of his traditionally, I don't know, I feel like John Williams just does really epic, like big brass, like
fanfares,
moving, yeah. Fanfares, yeah, right? And so to hear him move, like you said, in that jazzy direction, just it's refreshing, it's fun, and it really sets the stage for what is happening to Victor Navorsky as he tries to figure out how the heck he's supposed to live his life in this airport terminal.
Mm-hmm. All right, man, I'm glad we touched on it. I mean, however brief it might have been, I think it's a really good score. I think if people don't watch this movie, you should at least go check out the John Williams soundtrack. It's just phenomenal, as all of his work is. Brad, I do want to get into a little bit more analysis here. This movie, I think, in Spielberg's catalog is in a really interesting spot. So obviously we are post 9/11 here, and I think this movie really wouldn't work just on a plot level without, you know, the sort of cracking down and the TSA restrictions that you got after 9/11. But Spielberg really seemed to struggle with how to grapple with 9/11. There's a really great podcast out there called 21st Century Spielberg. I highly recommend checking it out, where this film critic, Chris Evangelista, he watches every one of Spielberg's 21st century films, and he really puts them into context. And he talks about how, you know, after 9/11, Spielberg's kind of idyllic, you know, like Americana attitude was really shattered. And, you know, I think the first movie he makes after 9/11 is Minority Report with Tom Cruise, which is like a huge dystopian movie. And it has that sort of like, you know, desaturated, drained of color look. And then right after Minority Report, he makes Catch Me If You Can, which is this kind of like throwback to the America that I once knew, you know, in the 60s. And then he does the same thing in this era. Like he does The Terminal, but then he's also doing War of the Worlds, and then he's doing Munich right after that. So it seems like he's trying to find a way for him as a filmmaker to talk about the troubles that are happening in America and what he saw as like huge cultural changes happening in America, but trying to find a way to do it authentically. And I think these movies are a really interesting kind of artifact of him grappling with that, because I don't know if any of them do a perfect job with it. But this one especially, I think, is kind of like unfairly criticized for being too fluffy, like too slight for Spielberg. But I think it might be one of the ones where he actually kind of delivers his thoughts on America and what America is becoming the most clearly.
Well, and I think that the authenticity that you find from Spielberg in this movie really is distilled in the relationship that Victor builds with these custodians and, you know, lower level staff of the terminal, if you will. Mm-hmm. That when you look at the way that they relate with one another, there's mistrust at first. But as they open up lines of communication, as they open up an ability to understand one another, that is where you see love formed. And I say love in the brotherly love, you know, sense of the word, that they really come to a place where they understand one another, they care for one another. They make it very obvious. This is a man from Eastern Europe, a man from India, and then a man from Hispanic culture, and then there's a black man. And you have this understanding that they are four people who are overlooked by the general society. Mm-hmm. And yet in the midst of that, they're able to form a camaraderie that overlooks their difference in skin color.
Yeah.
And they're different in accents. And I think that that is probably the most important message from this movie, especially in a world, in a 2021 world, where it feels like everybody is pushing further and further apart from one another. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly the message that I think Spielberg most wants to send, right? Like, he's very much leaning into the melting pot as the American experiment as something that still works. And I think this is him really trying to be optimistic about where we can go. But I also think, you know, and you mentioned this too, like the Patriot Act, which hadn't been officially signed into law at this point, but we were already hearing things during this era about enhanced interrogation techniques. And you know, we knew about like people's suspicion towards immigrants in this era post 9/11. And it gets a very obvious thing that the script and that Spielberg are doing here with using Victor as a metaphor for how America is, you know, treats immigrants and treats people that come from the outside. And I think the best kind of distillation of that is that scene where they call Victor to play interpreter for this Russian guy who very obviously is trying to get medication to his dying father in Russia. And Victor kind of outsmarts Tucci's character, because Victor's been reading the immigration forms so much that he knows that if the medication is for an animal, they can't stop it from passing through. And that's the whole thing. Like, this guy doesn't have the correct form. So America's going to seize this life-saving medication and not let this guy take it with him back to Russia. And I really think that's where, you know, it might be a little too obvious at times, but that's where they really draw the comparison between what are we supposed to be about as Americans and what are we actually portraying ourselves as? You know, Stanley Tucci is really representing the bureaucracy here and the red tape that we make people go through. And Victor, even though he is a foreigner, is much more representative of the America that we all want. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if I can use a nerdy D&D reference here, you know, they have this thing called the alignment chart, and they've used this in a lot of people have used this in memes and stuff. But this idea of Stanley Tucci as being lawful evil and Victor Navorsky as being lawful good is something that just I couldn't get it out of my brain the entire time I was watching this movie. And it's the idea of this, that a lawful evil person or character is going to use the rules to screw everyone over, right? They're the rules lawyer. They're the person who catches you on, you know, a little minutia to make you screw up. And they're exactly what we hate about bureaucracy and red tape. And it always feels like somebody's looking for a gotcha moment. Like, oh, sorry, you can't take this medicine home because you filled out the wrong form or you know, something of the like. Whereas a lawful good person is going to respect the rules, do everything they can to follow the rules, but they're going to recognize when the rules fall short. Mm-hmm. And that there are times where there are situations that the rules weren't made for. And so in those times, you know, he still is using the rules. He's just bending them a tiny bit to say, you know what, actually, they're for a goat. And that means he's allowed to take them with him.
Right.
And I just absolutely love that aspect of Navorsky's character.
We haven't really talked about Tom Hanks that much in this episode. And I think it kind of goes without saying sometimes that Tom Hanks is just phenomenal. I do think that they're kind of asking him to do a lot here. They're asking him to carry a movie with this kind of cartoonishly thick Eastern European accent. And I do think for the most part, it works. Like, this movie wouldn't work if you didn't have somebody of Tom Hanks's caliber trying to pull it off. Even in the moments where they kind of leave his character out to dry a little bit, or like they don't quite know how to end a scene, so they just have Tom Hanks take a pratfall. And that's like, oh, he fell on the ground. Ha ha. I still think Hanks is doing really, really good work here.
Well, I mean, Bob, what kind of a Hanksgiving would it be if we didn't mention the fact that Tom Hanks is an American treasure that is freaking phenomenal in nearly every single thing he attempts to do? The dude is just amazing.
And, you know, like, I noticed, because I've seen this movie so many times now, I noticed little things in his performance this time around that I never noticed before. you know, like there's one scene where he meets up with Amelia after she gets off of a plane. I think it's they're talking about Napoleon and Josephine. It's one of those times. And the camera lets them walk away and just kind of watches them walk away. And Tom Hanks is doing something that is like so similar to the way Charlie Chaplin walked in his movies. Like he's doing like a little tramp kind of character. And I really meant, like, if I had to ask Tom Hanks questions about this movie, I would ask him, like, did you try to model this character in some ways off of Charlie Chaplin? Because it makes sense. Like, the little tramp character in Chaplin's movies was always this kind of, like, down on his luck every man who got put into these hilarious situations with people that he didn't have any business being around. And that's really who Victor is. But I think Hanks imbues this character with these little touches that really help this movie transcend how just above average it is. You know what I mean? Like on paper, like it's an above average script. And Spielberg is such a great director that this is like, you know, B plus Spielberg work, but it would be like everybody else's A. You know what I mean? But oh, yeah. I think having Hanks really commit to this role did take this movie to the next level a little bit for me.
Yeah. And I think if that can take us into our final scores, for me, like you said, Bob, this movie without Hanks and without Spielberg, like if you just replace those two pieces and you have everything else in place, even the John Williams score, like I think the movie's like a 6.5 to a 7 out of 10. But as it is, the way you have this crafted, I think it's an 8 out of 10, Bob. I think it's a really solid, fun movie that anybody can get lost in and really enjoy themselves. So yeah, for me, it's an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, Brad, I'm going to come out to an 8.5. I think like my heart on this movie is like, it's a 9 out of 10. It's not a 9 out of 10. It's like a really, really cute and charming way to pass 2 hours. But I think it does kind of transcend all of the rom-coms I've ever seen in my life that, you know, I could also say that same thing about, because it does try to get at some deeper issues. I think the dramatic elements work really well for the most part, and because it just has some of the best to ever do it, you know, doing it in this movie that in so many ways doesn't seem like a project any of them would take on. And yet I'm so grateful that they did. So I'm coming out to 8.5. Brad, you're coming out to an 8. That takes us to an 8.25 out of 10. But we would like to know what you think. Have you seen The Terminal? If not, throw it on Thanksgiving. This is, Brad, this is a perfect Hanksgiving movie.
Oh, dude. I can't imagine a better movie that is like family friendly, fun, engaging, and interesting to kind of throw on in the background as people are eating their second leftovers. And I 100% put this on Thanksgiving night.
And if you want to talk to us about it after you've stuffed yourself with turkey and watched Tom Hanks, you can find us on our social medias on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Film Whiskey.
Or jump on our Discord. We are on there constantly talking with our community. So there are so many wonderful people that you can talk to about whiskey, talk to about movies, talk to about trucking, about New Orleans. There are so many different things you can learn on the Film and Whiskey Discord. There's a link to it in every single set of our show notes.
If you've been following along for season 5, then you know that at the end of each episode, we're putting the other person's list of movies into a wheel selector randomized list on the internet, and we spin the wheel and pick next week's movie. Brad, I have my finger on the trigger here. I want to spin this wheel and see what we're picking for next week. Can you make pretend wheel sounds while this one spins around?
Click, 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 click.
All right, we are going to be watching the Walt Disney animated film Tangled next
week.
Hey, oh, I'm excited. I like that movie a lot.
Dude, I think it is one of the best like modern animated films of the 21st century.
Absolutely.
It's just really good. I'm so pumped to talk about it.
All right, well, from me and Brad, truly, we hope you have a happy, happy Thanksgiving, a happy Hanksgiving. We'll see you again a week from Monday. So we are releasing this episode a little bit early. A week from Monday, we will be back with the Tangled episode. But until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.